thanks to all of you for coming. I'm humbled that you chose to spend some of your time with me today. And like Steve said, I realized as I watched you guys trickle in that a lot of you were interview subjects for a number of our presentations. So I'm imagining that you're going to be as grateful that Capstone season is over. Thanks for being here. My project I titled Mutual Missions, A Window into Mennonite Engagement with the Margins. I want to start by introducing you to my friends Jonathan and Karina. I met Jonathan and Karina about 3 years ago when they started coming to Sunnyside Mennonite Church's Tuesday night neighborhood meal. It's called TAF, Tuesday at the House. Jonathan and Karina occupy marginal spaces in a number of ways, socioeconomically, educationally, kind of with their family system and their background. So about a year into our relationship, Jonathan and Karina excitedly told my wife Kate and me that they were pregnant. And we weren't quite sure how to respond. We were a bit concerned about their situation, about their maturity, about their commitment to one another, about their ability to care for a child. Not long after that, actually when they shared with us, Kate and I knew that we were also pregnant, but we hadn't told anyone yet. And so a couple weeks later, we shared with Tath that we were going to be having our first child. So we got to walk alongside Jonathan and Karina. The four of us got to walk together as we experienced pregnancy for the first time. Jonathan and Karina's son was born a couple weeks before Ivy, and so that was a really fun experience to walk together in that. And through that relationship, through that experience, our relationship, the four of us, was transformed in an interesting way from kind of a mentor-mentee relationship to more of a mutual friendship. And that happened in a number of ways. Jonathan and Karina taught me and Kate about what it means to show unconditional love. When they responded to our pregnancy announcement with just kind of sheer joy and excitement, Kate and I realized that we responded to their pregnancy announcement with a bit more concern and hesitation. So we had to examine ourselves in that way. Jonathan and Karina have shown us some pretty radical generosity in the gifts that they have given to our daughter Ivy, and it caused us to examine the ways, kind of our middle class sensibilities about how we assume money is best spent. I think the gift that we gave them was a pack of diapers, which feels really lame now that I think about it. Jonathan and Karina have shown deep commitment to TAF. And they're teaching us about what it means to be committed to the worshiping community. They each walk from their house, which is about a mile away, every Tuesday night to be with us. And Jonathan rearranges his work schedule every week to make sure that he can attend. And I've come to realize that they show more commitment in that way than a lot of people who join us at Sunnyside for Sunday morning worship. That's been convicting for me. And finally, since Jonathan and Karina's son was born a couple weeks before Ivy, they shared a lot of wisdom and knowledge about the birthing experience with us. We felt genuinely better prepared through their advice. Some things, maybe more than we needed to know, they shared about the pros and cons of circumcision, among other things. But it caused us to examine the ways that we kind of gain wisdom and knowledge and what that looks like. So I share this story because this has been an inspiration for this project for me, my relationship with Jonathan and Karina. And the transformation that I've experienced, maybe in a small way, has kind of been the impetus for this project. So I'm asking two framing questions through this research. Number one, in what ways are Mennonite churches in Lancaster City building relationships with marginalized people in Lancaster? So in other words, are we doing missional engagement with the margins? That's kind of the umbrella question. And then the focus question is, in what ways do these relationships become mutual, transforming not only those on the margins, but those of us at the center? And I'm identifying myself in that privileged space. So these questions are kind of based around a missional framework. Missional ecclesiology is all about moving into third spaces, spaces where we don't kind of traditionally occupy as the church, and engaging with the people who are there, using their language, using their rituals. One critique of missional church ecclesiology is that it's promoted primarily by privileged white men. And so that opens itself up to this critique. If missional ecclesiology, if missional church is done kind of unconsciously, it can be a way of just rebranding some colonialist tendencies that we've seen kind of throughout church history, missions. So the reason that I'm asking about how our missional engagements are becoming mutually transformative, is because I see that as kind of a check or balance on this colonialist tendency that could undergird some of the missional movement. So I believe that if we, those of us at the center, those of us with privilege, are being transformed through these relationships with people on the margins, then that's an authentic means of engagement. So I'm using this phrase, people on the margins, quite a bit in this project, and I'm using this very intentionally. My definition of this phrase is anyone who is deemed insignificant, unworthy, peripheral, or on the edges of society. And more importantly, perhaps, is that I'm aiming to identify social location without exerting judgment on character or worth. So society identifies people on the margins generally as people without worth, that they have nothing to contribute for whatever reason, lack of education, lack of power, lack of money. As the church, I believe that we are called to view all people as created in God's image, that we are called to look for the ways that God is present and active with people on the margins. And so this term is again meant to identify their social location without passing judgment on them as people. So for my research, the primary mode of research was through interviews with 7 privileged Mennonite churches in Lancaster City, and I attend one of them, and so I can say that it's not easy to recognize our congregations as privileged. The way that I identify that is by owning their own church building, employing paid leadership, and consisting of a primarily Anglo-worshipping body. So there are 7 churches that match that definition in Lancaster City, and those were my focus for research. So the rest of this time I'd like to spend making a few observations out of this research that I've done, out of these interviews, and then I'll conclude with some projections. For those of us who want to take this work seriously, ways that I see that we can move forward, things that we can be self-conscious about as we think about engaging people on the margins in a mutually transformative way. So the first observation that I made out of these interviews is kind of the simple affirmation that we care about people on the margins, and as privileged congregations, we engage that space in different ways. So we're doing good contextual work, and it's clear from these interviews that we care about this work. The second observation that kind of ties into that is that we struggle to identify and name the ways in which this engagement is shaping us. As one pastor said, find my place in my notes here. It's easy to engage the intellectual questions about privilege and marginalization. That's a lot easier than thinking about how we are changed ourselves as churches and as individuals. So one conclusion that we could draw from this is that if we can't name the ways that this engagement with the margins is shaping us, then maybe it's not actually shaping us. I think we need to take that seriously, but I also think that from this research, that's not necessarily the case. Mutual transformation and the transformation of ourselves is long-term work, and it can be sometimes hard to identify and name. And so I'm optimistic that this work is actually happening, and I'm going to share some examples of ways that it is happening. But I think the struggle to identify and name those things is still significant to point out, because if we can be self-critical and examine the ways that we are being transformed through these engagements, I think it has more potential to really take root and flourish in us and in our congregations. A third observation is that our buildings really do define us missiologically. Maybe this feels obvious, but every church that I interviewed owns its own building. And so, especially as Mennonites, we are really good at hosting. We know how to do hospitality in our own spaces well. We have very few examples of ways that we are hosted, especially by people on the margins. And part of this is simply because Part of the power that we have is that we have the space to gather by owning our own buildings. We have the space to do this. And so we kind of default to being hosted. One pastor shared with me, he said, "We have one man who struggles with mental illness. He's very poor. He's embarrassed to drive his car to our church. I tell him, if you drove a nice car to our church, that would be the problem." I think this pastor's onto something, but he's also noticing, I think, a point of discomfort for a person on the margins as far as being hosted that we probably wouldn't notice as people at the center. You know, we drive our cars to our churches all the time and we don't think anything of it. I want to share a story about a way that we at Sunnyside are learning about what it means to be hosted. The woman on your right is Tiny. She's a kind of an anchor member of the Sunnyside neighborhood, and she also attends TAF and our Sunday morning worship. Every year, Tiny throws a big party for her extended family, and she uses our church fellowship hall. And she totally decks this space out. She decorates it. She has a big feast with fried chicken. She invites her whole family, and she gives her testimony and plans some programs. She also invites usually about 10 members of the Sunnyside congregation who are not part of her family or the Sunnyside neighborhood. And so here's how these parties usually play out. So say they start at maybe 3 o'clock. By 3:05, all 10 or so members of the Sunnyside congregation have arrived. 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, Tiny's family kind of trickles in, bringing food, greeting one another. Maybe 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock is a time of welcoming and informal greeting and chatting and catching up. And maybe by 5 or 5:30, the kind of programmatic piece of the party starts. We start eating, Tiny shares, and we do some other things together. This is a very different sense of time than those of us who kind of operate on a white middle-class sense of time are used to. It doesn't feel prompt. It feels scattered. And so the learning curve, I think, for me, and I've done this, is that some of us from the congregation will come for maybe the first couple hours, as long as it takes to get some food, and then we'll have to go for another commitment. Or we won't come at all because it's just too much of a time commitment for the afternoon. Whereas Tiny's family, there's this sense that they've blocked out their day and that this is a space to be together and to celebrate and that they're prioritizing these relationships. So this is a space where for those of us who are used to hosting, it's not necessarily the most comfortable or intuitive space to be. And so we're learning what it means to be gracious guests in that space. Fourth observation is that our engagement with people on the margins moves us to humanize them, which is a process that actually draws us into self-work. This is really significant. So humanization, of course, is about moving beyond stereotypes, moving beyond our assumptions and biases about other groups of people, and actually getting to know people in those groups, whatever margins those might be. One pastor shared that humanizing the other keeps opening us up. He and his congregation, we start to value people differently. We see people as someone who could be my brother, who has feelings, who could be easily hurt, who has fears. He said, "I'm starting to relate to everybody with a higher view. I see that as a gift. As a pastor, I start to see everyone as my sheep, my people, rather than the people that just gather on Sunday morning." This is a really significant observation that's made out of the humanization process and this pastor's own sense of self-work. That as he engages people on the margins, the way that he then turns inward is opening him up to not just see his own congregation that gathers on Sunday morning as his sort of pastoral space, but his entire context, the people that he encounters kind of in life throughout the week. This same pastor shared another story with me about self-work and humanization. One Sunday morning, this congregation has a person with some mental disabilities who worships with them on a regular basis, and this person came forward for communion kind of chatting loudly, and he proceeded to eat a lot of the bread and drink a lot of the cup. And the way this pastor responded, I think, was really significant. He said, "That experience teaches us that maybe I should come like that. Maybe there's something wrong with me, not him. He knows he is in big need, so he makes a big public display of coming to Jesus. We recognize ourselves as the Pharisees in that moment, questioning our motives. So again, the humanization process is opening this congregation up to self-work, to examining assumptions and biases and the way that that informs the way that they worship and function. It was clear to me in all of these interviews, there are other examples I could share, it was clear that this kind of self-reflection, when it comes to engaging people on the margins, when we open ourselves to self-reflection, that always leads to change. And these are some tangible ways, I think, that we are being transformed, maybe in small ways, by our engagements with people on the margins. Our worship becomes more fluid. So as people enter into relationship in worship who are not maybe from Mennonite tradition, who are not from kind of middle class background, they bring a different set of questions and a different framework for approaching life. And so our ways that we worship, even our rituals, become more fluid to integrate them in a holistic, healthy way. Success is redefined. As people who are pushed aside, again, that definition of people on the margins, people who maybe are deemed worthless by society, enter into relationship with them, we realize that they have significant gifts to offer to us and to the gathered community. And so we talk about success in a different way, and we make space for those gifts in new ways. And finally, our language changes. You know, it's one thing to talk about poverty as a group of privileged people. It's another thing to talk about poverty when there are poor people in your midst. And that's one way that our language is being shaped. As people on the margins enter our spaces, we are invited to examine the way that we talk about other people and just kind of life in general. So that's another way that self-reflection is leading to change in our congregations. Fifth observation is that missional mutuality must be at the core of a congregation's ecclesiology if we want to be shaped by our engagement with people on the margins, that placing any other priority at the center automatically excludes some people. And this was a reality that grew out of not only my interviews, but a lot of research has been done about this. Alan Hirsch has done some really good writing about this, and he's drawing on another number of other surveys, but he's noted that congregations that are focused or formed around a priority other than mission rarely ever get to do mission. So a congregation that's formed around a particular worship style or a particular way of praying or whatever it might be, whatever that core is, those congregations maybe do that well, but rarely actually do missional engagement, even if they hold that as kind of a secondary priority. On the other hand, congregations that are formed around this desire to do missional engagement then do that, but they also incorporate this worship and prayer and discernment and these other practices because, Alan Hirsch says, those are the means by which mission happens. So when our starting point is something other than mission, we rarely get to do that. When our starting point is mission, we not only get to that, but we kind of incorporate these other practices as a means to do mission more authentically, more in the way of Jesus. So these are just two models of church that Alan Hirsch illustrates to kind of explain what I just said visually. One congregation that I interviewed shared with me, and this is a congregation that engages the margins in a number of really good ways, but they shared some honest reflection with me, and so I'm going to pick on them without naming them. This congregation did a survey in the last number of years that asked congregants, what would you be willing to change about worship, or how much would you be willing to change about worship to be more open and welcoming to a broader group of people? And the answer that they got from their survey was basically nothing. And I think that's some really good honesty. I think that all of our congregations could say that about something. If we were asked, what are you willing to change to be more open to a broader group of people, there's something that we would say, this we're not willing to change. And my critique of that is that holding that at the center then automatically excludes some people. If we hold that as a priority above relationships with whatever group, especially whatever group of marginalized people, we are becoming exclusive in that way. Final observation. is that engagement with people on the margins is inviting us to redefine what it means to do church. Much of our engagement with the margins happens outside of Sunday morning worship. The vast majority of it does. And so that points to a number of things. I mean, it asks questions about how our Sunday morning worship is structured missionally, if that's the best space for us to be engaging in this way and to be mutually transformed. It also asks that we hold our Sunday morning worship experience alongside other experiences of Jesus, alongside other ways that we are transformed into the way of Jesus outside of Sunday morning worship or whatever space that traditional worship happens in. So, for example, a couple weeks ago, I had the chance to travel with a number of friends from the Sunnyside neighborhood to Baltimore to hear a Nobel Peace Prize winner speak. And that was an experience of Jesus. That was a time that I think the 12 or so of us who went grew in some small but significant way more into the way of Jesus. And so that was an experience of church for me. One pastor noted that he sees his congregation's Sunday morning worship time as a space for equipping and sending, so that congregants can do missional engagement in their context throughout the week. So church, Sunday morning worship does not necessarily represent the pinnacle of the religious experience. He said, people are doing things that we don't even know about. They're just involved in stuff. We're not organizing and coordinating it. We don't do a lot of structural stuff around it. He says, I'm excited when I hear it. It's really what I want to see. But how do we label that or highlight it even more than we are? We don't have words for it yet. So that's a way I think that one of our congregations is starting to embody this calling. Another pastor shared with me, and this is an example now of how we also as we rethink what it means to do church, that not only relates to spaces outside of our traditional worship, but also relates to our traditional worship space. One pastor said in his congregation, people love four-part singing, but someone from the community who came to Vacation Bible School, was baptized, came to faith, and is really committed, she talked to me once and said, why is our music so sad? He said, I experience it as beautiful, harmonious, but for her it doesn't have that joyful aspect. So part of rethinking what it means to do church, if we want to be transformed by our relationships with people on the margins, is that we have to listen to those voices that are entering our worship spaces and ask what it means to be a welcoming presence and to incorporate the gifts that they bring and the questions that they bring into our worship as well on Sunday morning. All right, I want to spend a little bit of time making some projections, things that we might think about as we consider what it means to move forward in this work as congregations. I'm going to frame this around Simon Sinek's Golden Circle, which is, I think, a really helpful model for any organization to consider. Simon Sinek is writing primarily for the business world, but I think this model has a lot of applicability outside of that. He says that every organization functions in these three realms: the why, the how, and the what. So the why is the core of any organization. It's the reason they exist. It's the kind of undergirding foundation that brought them into existence and that fuels them. The what, this outer ring, for a for-profit business would be a product or a service, whatever is produced. For our congregations, it might be programs or something like that. So you have the core and you have the product. The how, then, is the sort of vehicle by which the why turns into the what. So the how is the process that the why becomes the what. So I want to talk about each of these related to our Mennonite engagement with people on the margins and how I see these. And I want to suggest that as privileged Mennonite congregations, I think we occupy a bit of a unique space in this. I think that our why is pretty well defined. We have a little bit of tweaking to do, but this is a difference between what Simon Sinek is saying about most organizations and, I think, us as Mennonites, is that we have a pretty clear sense of this. And our what is also, I think, pretty well defined, though it also could use some tweaking. I think that our how is the gap, and so that's what I want to explore especially. So as we answer this question of why, as Anabaptists, I think what we get right is that we answer this question according to the way of Jesus. We turn to Scripture for the reason that we do mission. And especially as Anabaptists, you know, we read the New Testament as being about not just Jesus' death so that we can get to heaven, but as a means of transformation in the present. That as we follow the lead of Jesus in discipleship, there's power for us to be transformed, our lived experience in the present to be transformed. That's a gift. And when we experience that ourselves, then we're compelled to share that with other people. So that's what kind of propels us into mission, I think. And I think we have that right. I think that's really authentic. What I would like to add to that is that instead of moving into marginal spaces with only the desire to transform the other, that we move into those spaces with the desire to learn and grow and be transformed ourselves, recognizing that we are not Jesus, that we carry a piece of an experience of Jesus to the margins, but that they have a piece of that experience maybe to offer to us as well, that there's space for us to be transformed in that engagement. So our why, then, is mutual transformation according to the way of Jesus. How? The means that that happens. This is what I want to dig into a little bit. I think that we often jump from that why to what. What is kind of our programs that we run, without considering this how. And the vehicle, I want to propose that the vehicle through which our why becomes our what is discomfort, tension, and risk. So as we, and I'm saying we privileged Mennonites, think about engaging the margins, those spaces are always going to be uncomfortable and probably risky because by definition, the margins are spaces that the privileged do not occupy. And so these are spaces in which we're not necessarily comfortable. So are we willing to take that risk to engage in that discomfort? And then to be, as we engage in the process of transformation, there's going to be tension with that. Some of us feel that in our congregations already. Now, a piece of this is that we need to think about what it means to become marginalized ourselves. This takes careful discernment work. It takes engagement with Scripture and the gathered community. Because as Alan Hirsch says, we get to authentic mission through worship and prayer and discernment in the gathered community. Becoming marginalized ourselves is important because I think that if we do not aim for total integration of those on the margins through mutual relationship, then we will never hold our relationships with those on the margins on the same level as our relationship with those who are like us. We will always be able to move in and out of these spaces of margin. Margin will always be a secondary point of identification for those of us who lead lives of privilege. So finding ways to become marginalized ourselves means that we set aside that privilege of moving in and out of those spaces. This is hard work, and I don't have a clear answer for this. For some of us, it means that we actually physically relocate, that we move into a house in a marginalized neighborhood. For others of us, it might mean we find ways of integrating these third spaces into our everyday life. Maybe we take public transportation instead of driving our car, or we take our kids to play at the park instead of our own backyard, or we go to the public library instead of the coffee shop. This is growing out of missional church thinking. It's moving into third spaces. But the goal, I think, for those of us serious about engagement with people on the margins is that we learn what it means and enter into some sort of marginalization ourselves. This is what I see Jesus doing with the disciples as he sends them out without anything to rely on and asks them to go and be hosted, stay in people's homes, and share the good news. Learn what it means to encounter transformation when you don't have a safety net. So our what, then, the outgrowth of our core why, funneled through discomfort and tension and risk. We're primarily answering this question through programs as congregations, and I want to say up front, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I did notice in these interviews that most of us are much more able to talk about the programs that our churches are running than we are to talk about the relationships that are being formed through those. At least that's what we lead with. We lead with talking about the programs that we're running. So as we think about how we might shape our programs, I want to invite us to think about how we hold the relationships as the center of those programs, so that the programs do not become the end in themselves. The programs do not become the means by which we can hide from the self-work or that we keep a bit of safe distance from the relationship. So programs and structures are the means to relationship. That's the end in itself. One pastor told me that very few of our highly impactful events of the last year, as defined by the Church Leadership Board, had anything to do with our goals or programs. And so we hold these lightly, and we recognize them as the vehicle that leads us to relationship rather than the end in themselves. There's your quote. So just a quick summary of what I see as our opportunity moving forward. Our core why as privileged Mennonite congregations, as we think about engaging in mutually transformative relationships with people on the margins, our core motivation is mutual transformation according to the call of Scripture, according to the way of Jesus. The way that we do that is through entering into and being open to discomfort, tension, risk, and marginalization. And then the outgrowth of that are what? Our relationships, aided by structures, probably, but relationships are the end goal.
Thank you, Nate.
Yeah. Thank you.